I was like, oh shit, that's a big fucking problem. 3/4 of the world is going to live their whole life and realize on their deathbed, I blew it. I fucked it up. That's an issue.
I think, like, in particular me, if we did a third season, there's a strong chance I would have died.
And it was literally like I did a drug watching that. I was like, oh, I need more. I need more now. Whatever so I need to do to get more of this, I need more. Yeah.
You want to know the craziest shit? Please. You guys want to know some crazy shit?
This is the place to do it, Dave.
I was about to streak Kanye's performance.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the podcast. So excited to be back. I am actually currently in Shanghai, China, of all places. I've been here for a little over a week, and it's been incredible. But more on that later. There's going to be episodes coming out on the main channel. I'm so excited for you to see them. But for now, I just wanted to let you know a few things. Firstly, a few weeks ago, we took time off from posting on this podcast because of the situation that was unfolding in the Middle East and continues to unfold. And we made a post on Instagram with our thoughts on the situation, but we've also decided as a team that we're going to do a specific give back financially. We're still figuring out the details of it, but we'll make an announcement soon on the main channel on what that is. The second thing is we've decided to push the book launch by 2 weeks. So now the book is releasing on December 3rd at the end of this year. So it's coming up soon. I'm so freaking excited for this book to come out. And the third thing is that we will be posting 2 podcasts a week from now on until December 21st. So now on Mondays and Thursdays, you will be getting a podcast, a different conversation with an amazing person that I love for my going away party. This is our first podcast back after a little time away. It's with my idols, Ben and Dave, who are 2 of the 4 founders of the MTV show, The Buried Life, which aired from 2010 to 2012. It was a show that changed my life completely and became the seed for Yes Theory. And Yes Theory truly, truly would not exist without them. So truly one of my favorite conversations of all time, not just for a podcast, but just in general. As you'll see, I think you'll get so much out of it, and I truly hope that you enjoy it. Alrighty. Love you.
Wow. Wow.
You know, I started to say zao for things that are like above wow.
I like that.
Just because wow gets so overused. So if it's like really wow, zao.
Zao. This is definitely a zao.
Right?
It's a zowser.
It's a zowser.
Zowser? Is zowser more than zao?
Yeah, I don't know. Dave just said that. Yeah, I think so.
Just jumping on board, seeing if I can contribute. The microphone! First time. Okay.
Yeah, Dave's first time doing a podcast. How do you feel?
I'm a little bit nervous. I'm not going to lie, but I'm excited and I feel very honored and privileged to be part of this farewell journey.
Thanks, man. Yeah, it's an honor to have you guys here. I was telling Ben because Ben and I were supposed to do this solo, and I was like, I feel like getting at least 2 of you together would really create the vibe that I was trying to look for, like a TBL vibe. And then when he said you'd be down to fly out, I was like, fuck yes, dude, let's go.
Dude, I was so stoked. I was like, oh my gosh, I want to do it so bad. Let's go.
Yes, amazing.
And we've never done this before, for like a podcast together.
Wow.
No. I mean, and like, we used to do interviews together all the time, mm-hmm. but in the last decade, I mean, a long time, we haven't done it.
Yeah. So, I haven't done anything on camera or anything like this in years.
Damn.
Yeah.
You've done, I guess you do like Instagram clips and stuff, but
yeah, but even that I've in the last 3 years, I've kind of backed off of socials in a big way. So I'm just, living the in-person experience.
Wow.
Yeah.
Same here, dude. Feels good.
It feels good
to live in person. I'm a little nervous too, to be honest. I get a little nervous before these podcasts just because the people I bring on mean so much to me. And I feel like there's so much I want to share and so much I want to listen to that I'm like, oh boy, this is like a once in a lifetime opportunity, you know, and I really want to take full advantage of it. And maybe I'll start off by being a little bit vulnerable. I like, it's really this weird line for me to navigate doing these podcasts because it's both like this experience I'm going through is like both very like fun and celebratory, you know, but it's also very bittersweet and sad at times. So my emotions are like constantly going back and forth. And sometimes I'll wake up in the morning and it'll feel a little overwhelming. And today I woke up and I when that happens, I have to like lay down on my bed and just feel. I have to feel into my feelings. And I was thinking about you guys, and I was thinking about this podcast, and I just started to cry.
Oh my God.
Yeah, I just started to cry a lot. If you see like red in my eyes, why? And I was thinking about why, and what came up was you guys were, for me, the impetus. You were the beginning of a new life. Like, I went from being this party college kid to suddenly watching you and feeling like the world opened up. And since then, you know, obviously my life has changed in a multitude of ways. And now that this new chapter is beginning, now that I'm saying goodbye to this life, it's like, it's getting to sit down with the people that started this journey for me is, again, that bittersweet feeling comes up where I'm like, holy shit, like, if it weren't for you guys, I wouldn't be here. I was telling Brian this, like, the all of this wouldn't exist without you. So I think for me, maybe the place to start is, like, I want to fangirl a little bit because this is kind of epic. It's like an epic moment. Matt in college would be totally freaking out right now that he was getting to have this conversation. And I've told you guys multiple times what you mean to me, so it's no longer a surprise. But yeah, I think it's, I mean, when I think back and writing the book helped me process a lot of this, it's been wild to watch not only me, but the impact that you guys have had on my generation and the generation after. Like, there's so many young people that you influenced who completely changed the course of their lives. And I was thinking about 506, you know, the house that we had down the street. And I'd say like every other person that was a creator that came through that house that we vibe with was doing what they were doing because of you guys. And last night, Dez and I was like, let's freaking sit here and just watch a few episodes of The Buried Life. So we watched season one, the first three episodes, and then one more. And we kept looking at each other and we were like, this is iconic. What you guys did was totally iconic. And I don't want to just keep making you, like, putting you on your high horse, but there was this understanding of, like, so much of the content today, like what you guys were doing back then, you see it a lot now, but like, that was the start of it. You know, like the different cuts you were doing, like the openers that you had, like the doo, 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 you know, and the cuts in between of you guys dancing with your posters, and like even these little thing, the music choices, the buildups, even the ideas of the episodes. Mm-hmm. And if people watch The Buried Life, they'll see like where so much of the influence for Yes Theory came from. So I am obviously from this monologue a super fan. but for those who aren't, I would love for you guys to kind of give a brief recap mm-hmm. of what TBL is. And I'd love to hear it in your own words because I feel like it'll come better from you than it would from me. So maybe let's start there.
Yeah, I just want to say, like, I so appreciate what you said. And it's also kind of a full circle moment for us, because when we embarked and hit so many roadblocks along the way, we would always say to each other, like, the ripple effect of this, like the people that will be influenced to do things, like, we will hear about this in the years to come. And it's just crazy to have this conversation and be like, oh, damn, like, this is that moment. And it's just so amazing that you were inspired by the show. I'm so just so happy to hear that, because we really, like, that was its sole purpose. Like, that really was, if you boil it all down, was to inspire people to take action. So
And what's cool is too, yeah,
she did it.
It's
she
fun. It, it's dude. Fun to think back too, and to take a trip down memory lane, especially with Dave here, because we haven't done it in a very, really long time. So I think it'll be fun to tell the story. But the other thing too is that, as Dave said, we had this mantra from day one, which is really was our guiding mantra, which is, what would our friends think? Everything came back to, would this inspire our friends? Would our friends think this is cool? You know, because we felt like we can never tell our friends what to do, but we knew that they had more potential. We knew they were doing something that they didn't really love. Like there was another thing they actually wanted to do, and no one could tell us what to do. So we thought, well, we'll just show them how much fun it is to live this way, and hopefully they'll do it. And now you've become our friend through this process. And so to hear that that was the thing that inspired you to make that shift, that was kind of, as Dave said, that was always the goal. It was just like, that's why we cared so much, because we knew our friends would watch it and we knew we wanted to change them. And so with the show, we put that was 2 years, it was a black hole. I don't even remember. We slept at the editing bays. We paid editors out of our own pocket after MTV had locked it. That was everything to us.
I would be typing on the computer and my hair would be falling out onto the computer. I was literally going bald because we just weren't sleeping. We were just editing and re-editing and editing and re-editing, mm-hmm. and just like going crazy. Mm-hmm. And in particular with the first season, because it was our baby and our entrance into the world. Mm-hmm. And we just destroyed ourselves.
Yeah. So
Worth it.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. So, do you want to start the story from the beginning?
Please.
No, I think you started. So it's kind of different for both of us, but Buried Life started for each of us. We were in a dark place, and we were going through something different. I was going through a depression. I was post depression, kind of. I dropped out of school. I was high level. Like playing rugby on the under 19 national team, put so much pressure on myself. I don't even know why I always put pressure on myself, because my parents didn't, but I just wanted other people to like me. So I was like, if I do well, people will like me. I put so much pressure. So I just, at the first moment when I realized that I was not in control of everything, which was like, once I was competing at a high level, I realized like, I can't control everything in my life. I started to just nosedive. So I was coming out of this depression, and I was realizing that I had lived a life that, like, I was living the dream, but I wasn't living my dream. So on paper, everything was great, but I was actually not doing the things that I truly loved. So when I linked up with these guys, I was like, I want to surround myself with people that make me feel more like me, make me feel more alive, people that inspire me. And I was inspired by a friend that started a clothing line in high school. And so I realized that I really wanted to make a documentary or a TV show or a sketch show or something like that. And the only person I knew that did that was a kid named Johnny. And Johnny was also friends with Dave. So I called up Johnny out of the blue. I only knew him because he took my sister to prom. And I was like, called him three times. First two times he ignored me. Third time he picked up. If he didn't pick up that call, you know, Buried Life wouldn't have happened. I was like, Johnny, this is totally out of the blue. But I feel like we should make a documentary. And he's like, I was just talking to my friend Dave about this in Cuba. I was like, no way. You call Dave. I'll call your older brother, Duncan. And we all started talking about this film that we had no idea what it was going to be about, but we just felt like we wanted to make something.
Yeah. And so I went to first year university, really, just because that's what you were supposed to do. You know, like there's so much peer pressure. And for me, with someone like, I've got severe dyslexia, pretty intense ADHD. So going to university was essentially like going to prison. And it was the worst thing that I could ever do. But I went, I got crazy depressed. I put on 45 pounds. I was just miserable. Like every night calling like anyone who would listen to me and being like, what do I do? Like, I like don't even want to live, you know. I was just so down and out. And then Aaron, the same guy who started the clothing line, I started talking to him, and he was like, "Dude, you can do anything you want. Like, you can like, you want to be Jim Carrey, you can be Jim Carrey. Like, you can literally do anything you want. You just have to start taking action." And that guy, you know, really single-handedly like lifted me out of my depression. And then we got onto these phone calls like a few months after, and started talking about, you know, if we could do a documentary on anything, what would it be? And someone said, you know, let's take 2 weeks and everyone write down anything that you'd want to do a documentary on. And we came back, everyone had a list of 50, and we were just going through these ideas, and everyone was like, oh my God, that would be amazing. That would be amazing. I want to do all these things. And then it kind of triggered that thing of like, you know, why don't we go after everything that we want? Why don't we go make a list of 100 things to do before we die? And then like, why don't we help a complete stranger that we meet along the road, just in the street, do something that they want to do? So it's not just like us going after our stuff. Like, let's bring everyone in.
Yeah. And then Johnny, by the way, all four of us independently were inspired by Aaron.
Actually?
Yes. Independently. I was so inspired by Aaron that I was like, I called him up out of the blue. I was like, I saw your clothing line. It's so cool. Is there anything I can do to help to get involved?
Was it a big clothing line or?
No, but it just was like, you know, I had never seen anybody that I knew do something like that. Mm.
Yeah. And it had a moment in Canada where it was in Time Magazine, it got listed as like, it was a charitable clothing line. So it made Time Magazine. Yeah. And it was just crazy to go to high school with someone and then their clothing company is in Time Magazine. You're like, wait.
And it was dope. It was great clothing. It was really cool. And it gave back, which was in a cool way. So we all got sparked by this guy independently. And so then we start talking, but we didn't know what the name of it was going to be. And then Johnny got assigned a poem in English class at McGill called The Buried Life. And he sent it back to us. He's like, read this poem. And this poem is a 150-year-old poem that basically talked about the exact same feeling that we were feeling, which is we felt buried. All these dreams we had, all these things we wanted to do never saw the light of day. Like they were all buried. And we had like moments when we were inspired, but we never acted on it. So nothing ever happened. We never did them. And Johnny's like, this is the fucking feeling. This is the thing. This dude's talking about this 150 years ago. Let's call this documentary The Buried Life. And we're like, okay, Johnny. Whatever, Johnny. Yeah. I'm not going to read that long poem.
You are a smart man. That sounds like a good idea.
Yeah. And now I look back on the poem and I'm like, oh my God, this is like the truth.
Mm.
This is literally, this feeling is a human condition. Like this is the universal feeling where this is why people don't go after their dreams, because they get buried by everything else in their life. At that point, we did not think about it as a big kind of life pursuit or any type of lesson. This was just like, we want to go out, have as much fun as possible and help other people do the thing they want to do. And so we're like, great. Okay. Call it The Buried Life. It's a little bit of a weird name, but let's do it. Let's make it happen. So now we're like, okay, we need money. So we started throwing parties in Victoria and we started cold calling companies out of the phone book, pretending we had a production company, saying we're making a documentary and they should get involved. We got a juice company to pay for our gas. We got Red Bull to give us Red Bulls, a granola bar company to give us granola bars for the road. We borrowed Johnny and Duncan, who are brothers, their uncle's old RV, made decals. We call them decals. You call them decals in the US, which is always like, you're like, what the hell are decals? They're called decals.
For the record.
So, and it said one film, four guys, 100 things to do before you die on the side of this old RV. And we get the RV checked out by a mechanic to make sure that it'll make it back, because we didn't have the money to tow it back. And mechanic's like, this isn't going to make it. Do you remember the moment, by the way, where we're the night before we're about to go, we're sitting outside Duncan's old place and we're like, what do? We don't have the money to tow this back if it breaks down. This is a dumb idea. Like we shouldn't do this.
Yeah.
Do you remember what you said?
No.
So we're all like, this isn't going to work. And Dave's sitting on the crowd. I remember this like so clear. And Dave's like, guys, we've come this far. We have to do it. And that was it. We're like, all right. Literally, I remember being like, this is just a dumb idea. Like, how is this going to work? And so we didn't tell anybody, by the way, that we were doing this. Like none of our friends, even our family didn't really understand because we're like, we didn't really know what the hell we were doing.
Was this the summer? Like, were you guys still in school?
No, we'd worked all through the school year, working jobs, saving up money. And then we took 2 weeks off at the end of 2006, the summer of 2006, to go and do this 2 week road trip before we went back to school.
Yeah. And then we called up all the local news companies. Like, this is a long story, so we can...
I don't think there's a lot here that I didn't know.
Okay, well, yeah. So we called up all the local newspapers in our town of Victoria and said, Ben Nempton is going to cross off this thing for the launch of our mega, like, bucket list tour, and he's going to be a knight tomorrow. So
first Ben, we said we're going to skydive in, but we realized you have to clear airspace, and we didn't know how to skydive.
Yeah, exactly.
Wait, so, he's going to dress up as a knight.
Yeah, I got like a full suit of armor for free on loan. Like, I traded beer to this guy that owned a restaurant for a gift certificate to this girl that rented this armor.
Wow. Yeah. And then Ben was just in the back of our RV, and he's in a full suit of armor, and randomly every one of these news companies showed up. So there's like a mob of reporters outside of our crappy RV, and Ben's just in the back in his full suit of armor sweating like, what do I do?
Like, I was so nervous. I couldn't walk. It was like 50 pounds of armor. Chainmail, sword.
So,
okay. Go.
No, please.
Well, I guess the plan was to get...
Oh, there's no plan.
No. Let me stop you right there. No plan, bro. So Ben's just like freaking out. We're like, Ben, just go out there. And Ben opens the door to like a mob of reporters. And this little boy with a sword is walking down the street, sees Ben, walks up, and goes down on one knee, and Ben knights him in front of the reporters, and everyone's just like, oh, and it just becomes this whole scene. And the next day we crossed off the second thing, which was make the front page of the newspaper.
Wow.
And from that moment, it just caught on like wildfire, like instantly. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that we were so blown away by is that first day we started asking people the question, what do you want to do before you die? And it was like no one had ever thought about it in their lives. Mm. They were like so taken aback, like, oh. And we were like, is no one thinking about this? Like, is this not top of mind? And that was like... right off the bat, it really became like, oh my gosh, like we need to ask as many people and get as many people thinking about what they genuinely want to do before they die.
Yeah. Wow. We would have people not know. They'd be like, I don't know. And then we'd go down the street. We'd ask every person two blocks up. 30 minutes later, they'd run up to us. Like, I know now. I thought of it. So it was like planting the seed. And keep in mind, this is pre-social media too, right? So this is all spreading through traditional news. We would
horse
drive.
And buggy, very big.
Yeah. Elementary stuff.
Yeah.
But powerful.
Yeah.
Carrier pigeons
were huge for us. Yeah. We did a pretty big push with carrier pigeons.
Yeah, big carrier pigeon campaign.
Yeah.
We did, we would drive our RV up to news stations. Every city we went, we just go straight to the local news and we would just stay there until they put us on the news.
Just to talk about what you were doing.
Yeah, just to get the word out on the radio. And then it started to grow. I
mean, we had an RV, so we literally would camp there.
Yeah,
we were like, we don't need to go.
Yeah.
We will outlast you.
Yeah. And then I remember one of the things was Crasher Parade. And we were in Penticton, which is a small town. There's this Peach Fest is called, and there's a parade. And we put like streamers on the side of our RV, draped them, and then just drove into the parade. And we're dancing on the roof. And people on the side of this parade, they're like, you're crossing off number 42. And we're like, how do they know? And then we realized, oh shit, people like know about this. And we look at our email inbox at that point. We had this email contact page on our website. And Johnny, I remember when we were in the restaurant one day, we like got onto Wi-Fi and we look at it and we're like, oh my God, we've like all of these emails from people from around the world that are starting to hear about this, being like, hey, we can help you cross off, ride a bull. We can help you cross off, make a toast at a stranger's wedding. And then sending us their dreams Like, guys, this is my biggest dream. Can you help?
And for context, this is 4 days in.
I was going to ask, is this within the 2 weeks?
No, this is what he's talking about is 4 days in to the project. So like it went viral in newspapers. So every national and then like global newspaper was calling us to do interviews. And then they would go in the newspaper the next day. So it was like we were getting all of this momentum instantly. So it was just, it was so crazy.
It was crazy.
Do you think it was the idea that did that? What? Because, I mean, my mind works in content nowadays, which is another impressive thing about you guys. Like, we've, you know, our videos, the reason we got so much attention is because of the algorithm, you know? But to do this on the ground organically, parking outside of news stations, it's a whole, it feels like a whole different world.
I'm just going to take a swing and say it was the same reason, it blew up the same reason that we were so frustrated. Like it truly felt, at least for me, that at that time, you could only do things that fit within the boxes of society. And I think that when the project came around and it was this four guys going after a list of 100 things and asking strangers, this everyone was so refreshed with like something that was outside of the box. And
And I think too, just the idea of four friends doing this was inspiring to people, which is something that we didn't think was going to be the case. In fact, we thought it was going to be the opposite. We thought people were going to be like, screw these guys. Like what, you know, like they're definitely not going to care about our dreams, which is why initially the documentary was just going to be about asking other people, what do you want to do before you die? And then helping them. Mm. And we were just going to do our list on the side because we wanted to, but it never was really going to be part of the film or the project because we thought it was self-serving. We're like, who the fuck cares? But we were surprised that people started to go after their dreams because we were going after ours. And that's when we started to understand this idea of the ripple effect, that when you do what you love, you inspire other people to do what they love. And once we realized that, it's like, oh man, this is the best win-win ever. We get to do what we love and we get to inspire other people to do what they love. We're going to keep doing this. And as Dave said, I just don't think people had seen that like we were doing it. Yeah. And we were going so big. Our dreams were so, it was go to space, cover of Rolling Stone, you know, write a New York Times bestseller, play basketball with Obama. Well, before it wasn't Obama in 2006, but it was these massive dreams. And we're just like, yeah, we're not going to do them, but we're going to try. And I think that people got caught up with this idea that like, wow, if these guys are doing it, why can't I?
I think the other thing that's interesting with the project is like a lot of the stuff we didn't actually think that we would be able to do.
Oh no.
And
most of them.
Yeah. And then through doing it and having this response, we were like, wait, is this stuff possible? And we're like, okay, like let's, and then like, we had to like even double down and we did this session where we did a second list and it was like, kind of taking our own medicine, but like everyone really asked themselves honestly, if you could do anything, what would those things be? And then we came and that was, you know, the master list that you see online today.
Damn. Was there any one of those items that was like, absolutely no way? I mean, I'm sure a ton, but is there anyone that sticks out as like a, when you wrote it down and then it actually came true?
Well, I actually didn't know how we were going to help anybody because we didn't have any money. Mm. So I remember calling Johnny before we left and I was like, dude, Johnny was like, yeah, we're going to do 100 list items and we're going to help 100 people in 2 weeks. I was like, Johnny.
You wanted to do it in 2 weeks?
Yeah, this was it. He's like, we're going to go do them all and we're going to help 100 people.
What?
I was like, oh Johnny, God. How are we even going to help anybody? And I remember him saying, we're going to figure it out. And I was like, all right. Like I never, my brain is very different than like Dave and Johnny, where they like, I'm analytical, I'm logical, right? I'm procedural. These guys are different. They think outside the box.
We're built different.
And it's so, very similar. Yeah, I'm much more like you.
Yeah.
And Thomas and Amar are much more like
100%, Dave. 100%. Yeah. 100%. Especially Amar.
Yeah.
And so, and Johnny was like, we're just going to, we're going to figure it out. And so that was like my, there was a couple moments where I just had to take a leap of blind faith. When Dave said, we got to do it, I'm like, all right. Johnny said, we're going to figure it out. And so the first person we ever helped, we didn't know how to help. It was this guy named Brent who had asked us to fulfill his dream of taking
Richard
pizzas.
Branson. Was it the Richard Branson one?
No, this is like two early days. First person we ever helped was a guy named Brent who wanted to bring pizzas to the homeless shelter, which we later found out he had lived in that homeless shelter. But we found out that he needed a truck because he had started this garage sale business to get himself out of the homeless shelter. And his truck, he had like go around, pick up stuff that nobody wanted at the end of a garage sale, and he would sell it new and used, or used shop anyways. So we ended up getting this guy a truck, but we didn't have the money. We had like $480. And so this used car salesman gave us a $2,000 truck for $400. And we just drove it up to Brent and we handed him the keys. And it was this moment when Brent was, no one had ever done anything like this for him in his life. We had never done anything like this for anybody. And it was very impactful for us. We were like, oh shit, this is what it's about.
Yeah. And we also got to see the used car salesman, his reaction of seeing that he facilitated it.
Yeah.
He got to see it.
He got to see it. And to see his reaction to be like, someone, I just helped someone out of the blue. And we were like, oh wow, like people need an opportunity to help. Mm-hmm. Like if you give someone an opportunity to help someone else, more than likely they're going to take it. And that was like, after that moment with Brent and we were this kind of off to the races. And at Brent, we said, this is more than a 2-week tour. We have to keep doing this. We need to keep pushing. And then 4 days later, we got an email from a Canadian producer named Scott Moore. And it's like a 2-sentence email, like, hey guys, you guys ever thought about making a TV show?
Yeah. He said, I want to help you cross off two things, make a TV show and give a stranger $100 bill.
That's right.
And he sent us $100 bill.
Cool.
This is literally, he like mailed us a bill.
You're kidding.
Right? Yeah. This is like pre Venmo, bro.
That's epic. So, that's the guy.
Yeah. So we met with him on the end of the 2-week tour in Vancouver. It was like the end of our loop back home, and we met him at a fancy hotel for breakfast. And we talked with him about going to Toronto to pitch networks on this show. And so long story short, we make a trailer. We posted on YouTube. That was the first thing we ever did and it made the front page of YouTube in 2006 or 2007.
Literally pretty much the year it came out.
Yeah.
Yeah. YouTube. I think it was the year it came out.
Wow. And we go to Toronto and we almost do a show with MTV Canada, but we don't because they want to own it. And we want to be executive producers and they won't let us be executive producers. And we want to, again, our filter, what will our friends think? We want our friends to be inspired by this. The only way they can be inspired by it is if we are in creative control. So we turned down the show.
Being 18 or 19 and turning down $30,000,
dude,
was one of the hardest things you can ever imagine.
Also all your own
us,
show.
Yeah, all of us were just so broke. And the contract came in and it was like so massive. And then we just kept on reading it and be like, oh, this, that doesn't sound good. Oh, we can be recast. Like, oh, that's a bit sketchy.
Recast?
Oh yeah. Yeah. It would have been a complete sign off. They would have had everything.
Wow.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So we turned it down and then we were like, okay, back to school, fundraise, work a job throughout the year, save up money. We got big sponsors on board. We got Levi's to give us a bunch of money so we could buy a bus, and we put them on our website. We made Levi's t-shirts. We got ready for the next tour and we're like, okay, next summer we're doing 2 months. We're going down to the States. We bought this old purple transit bus and we got a crew from LA to film us. We hired a full crew, two cameras, audio, director. And now we're like, we're really making this doc. Put all the money into the doc. Toured around the US. Again, magic happens. All this like incredible stories of helping people, serendipity helping us across things off our list. And we come back and we're like, all right, let's put together this documentary.
Well, I will just say, so I think an important thing to mention in that beat is we went to Burning Man and crossed that off. That was the first thing of the new tour,
yeah.
which was, you know, unbelievable. It was in 2007 where Burning Man was still like dangerous, where you're like, I think I could die at any moment. And you were right. You could.
And if you died, no one would know because you couldn't contact anyone on your last breath. No cell service. We told our director to meet us at Burning Man. We had no idea what it was. You couldn't even look at photos online because there was no, you had to have like a special pass to even take photos. We get there. We're like, oh God, we're, took us 2 days to find our director.
Yeah.
No way.
Yeah, we found him eating grilled cheeses with nudists. Yeah. But so we left.
With nudists. I just realized you said nudists. That's hilarious.
We left Burning Man and went to Vegas. Mm. And in Vegas, they were throwing the MTV Music Video Awards 2007. Britney Spears was headlining it. And we went and bought female matching suits. And
from a thrift store.
From a thrift store. And made a fake email from the Judy McGrath, the then president of MTV, saying we were shooting a pilot. And we drove our purple bus into the VIP line of the awards with all the limos. And we get to the front and the guy's like, who are you guys? And we're like, we're the Buried Life. We need to get in. We need to get in. And he's like, whoa, 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 whoa. And we're like, here's our email from Judy. And he looks at it and he's like, what? Calls in other security. We're like, oh, we're screwed, you know? And they come and they're like, this is from Judy McGrath? And we're like, yeah,
look. This is Judy. Judy McGrath.
This is Judy.
Do you not see
like,
the name?
Judy McGrath at Judy McGrath. And they're like, okay. They let us in. And we were able to cross off, walk the red carpet at a major award show. But like when we got out of that bus, we had security like open up the red carpet. We ran on, we were getting photos taken, just like people signing autographs. We got into the awards. Johnny was just like eating shrimp in the awards. Like
I got into the press. I think people thought we were the plain white tees.
I believe. Yeah. I think
so. I got into the press room and I got interviewed by InStyle and they're like, oh, we love your outfit. I was like, yeah, it's vintage.
Yeah.
Perez Hilton came up to me. He's like, I love your outfit. I was like, yeah, the pants don't do up. I go, but the pants are so small. I can't button them up. And we got out of finally they're like, the executive producer of the show after like 2-3 hours, like, who the fuck are you guys? Like, and they finally realized that we weren't supposed to be there and they kick us out. Mm. But after that tour, you know, I figure out a way to tell this story short. So I'm going to start jumping. So we come back from that tour. We're like, let's make the doc. We're ready. We got all this footage. Then we realize how expensive post-production is. We spent all of our money. Big down. Now we're like, I go working in a bar. Everyone goes off and does their own thing. We're like, oh, dude, we blew it. We turned down our own show. We just spent all of our money. We didn't pay ourselves a dime. We just like spent hundreds of thousands of dollars that we had raised from sponsors. Now we can't make the film. And it's over. No one's ever going to know what we did. And big down. I get depressed. I'm working in the bar.
I will say it was a big down for those three. I had drank our Kool-Aid so much that I had actually moved to LA to become a stuntman. I was actually living my best life.
That's right.
No way, I bounced. I didn't even go back to Canada. No I way. Stayed in the States. I was like, I'm going after what I want to do before I die, motherfuckers.
He went to go live with our director. I forgot about that.
No yeah, way. I moved in with Brad Tiemann, our director. And I started the hustle to become a stuntman in LA. Yeah.
Get out.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
And incredible. Then the next chapter is like getting the show on MTV. And so I'd randomly met this girl when I was in Mexico with my family that knew a couple people in LA. She flew me down on a buddy pass, which is a free flight. And I start meeting these people, random people in LA, a producer, someone at a management company. Everyone's like, oh, this is such a cool idea. We cut our own pilot, by the way, which was us crashing the VMAs.
Nice.
Yeah. Johnny edited the whole thing.
Johnny edited
and
the whole thing.
And like when he sent it to us, we were like, we couldn't believe watching that. It was a 9-minute pilot and it was just so exciting. Yeah. And those music cues that you're talking about. He was in Montreal, which was like the EDM capital at that time.
Justice just came out. Oof.
And he, like, it was so invigorating he sent to us.
Yeah.
And we were like, this is it.
Yeah, we were fucking fired up at that point. Yeah. So then it was just like, we're getting this show. And I just started doing trips down to LA. Dave was already there.
Stunting
the way. And we were able to get it in front of MTV. And Tony DeSanto, the president of MTV, who is the absolute man, was like, the only way we can fuck this up is by getting in your way and stopping what you're already doing.
No way.
Done. ABC and MTV both won the show. MTV we went with because we were going to have full creative control. We were executive producers. The president was on board and we're like, let's do it. So we all moved down to LA and started to cross off Make a TV Show.
Yeah. Big shout out to Liz Gately as well on that one. Too.
True, true.
Yeah. Liz Gately.
Liz Gately, yeah.
She's the head of Spotify now.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So that was now we were like, this is our job. Just doing the craziest stuff we could think of.
So you dropped, did you have to drop out?
I dropped out of school, yeah.
So everybody did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I had already dropped out trying to get it going.
Yeah.
And man, everyone came down and then off we go.
Yeah. We were all pretty much dropped out at that point. It was, we were
fully committed.
Fully committed.
Yeah. Four of us living in a 4-bedroom apartment
in LA.
Yeah. One car, just starting to go after. Survive on a deserted island, streak a field and get away, ask out Megan Fox, play basketball with Obama.
Crash the Playboy Mansion.
Yeah. Compete in a crump competition.
Oh my God.
So with that, were you guys like flying out to these places and filming and coming back, or were you taking the bus?
Yeah, a lot of it, we were driving the bus.
No, we drove the bus everywhere. Okay. Yeah, that's how.
And it would always break down.
Yeah, and that first tour was a gnarly tour. We drove our old transit bus. It broke down constantly. And that's how we shot everything. It's like, if we didn't fly anywhere, really, we drove.
Wow.
And we had to make that show differently than very much most reality shows. Cause back then reality was scripted completely, for the most part. Mm-hmm. And so you gotta just keep thinking, this hasn't really happened for most people in the industry, where these four kids come into this office, the production office, and now we're in control. We've never made a show. And they're like, okay, what do you guys want to do? We're like, well, we're going to do the craziest shit we've ever thought of. You know, get Jay-Z to a house party, you know, like crash the Playboy Mansion. They're like, okay, you want to crash the Playboy Mansion? We'll clear the venue so we can air the episode. We're like, no, what? No. You can't go clear it. You'll tell them that we're coming. We're crashing the Playboy Mansion. So it has to be real. If you're going to clear it, we're not going to do it. So the first episode was that one. And we had to, all the executives came down because they were placing bets of whether we were going to do it or not. If we didn't do it, we were going to lose control.
That first episode?
Yes.
Yeah, that was the deal. They're like, if you want control, then prove it. And if not, then we're coming in with TV magic.
Because it was like, we would blow $300K. We had a $330,000 budget for every episode.
For every episode?
Yep.
Damn. God, and for how old? You guys were like late teens, early 20s at that
early
point?
Early 20s. Yeah.
Jeez, dudes.
And so, but keep in mind, like that money goes like that. Yeah. We had 30 people. 40 people on every shoot. We kept telling people, don't come. Like, we want to do this just like how you guys mm-hmm. film. Just us, two camera guys, and that's Bootstrap. It.
Yeah.
We need to clear everybody. So we need crafty. So yeah, it was a crazy experience.
So that pressure on that first episode was insane then.
Yeah. Yeah, but like, we were stoked. You know what I mean? Like, it wasn't lost on us that like, this is just badass. And like, so like, yeah, the pressure was there, but honestly, I feel like the executives carried that pressure more than we did. Maybe I'm just speaking for myself.
You are speaking for yourself.
Yeah.
Like, I felt the pressure for sure. I was like, we had two ideas. Dave and Johnny's idea. It was a Oompa Loompa, or it was a Willy Wonka themed party. So they were like, we'll dress up like Oompa Loompas, get in the bottom of a prop cake, and we'll deliver that cake to the mansion, and we'll pop out of the cake in the middle of the party and no one will ever know. And I was like, that is a very dumb idea.
You really?
Dude, we watched it last night. It's wild to watch because you're like, it's never going to work.
I was like, this is never the dumbest idea.
He really was like, just don't do that and pick something else. And we're like, no.
Yeah, you were like, I think it's going to work.
Yeah.
You're like, I think it's going to work.
I was convinced it wasn't going to work. And my idea didn't work. And these guys got in the mansion and got free reign to do whatever they wanted because people thought they were working the party. And
yeah,
they did it and it worked. And from that moment on, we were in control and we were able to make the show that we wanted to.
That was the first episode I ever watched. It was also the first episode Thomas ever watched. The first episode I showed him. I mean, it's the first episode in the season, so it makes sense, but when Duncan drops off the cake and pushes it up the hill into the Playboy Mansion, I remember watching that. I was in high school. You're like, what? Are you fucking kidding me? Is this about to work? And there's a moment where Duncan drives away and he meets up with Ben and he goes, they're in. They're so fucking in.
Yes, I remember that. Dude, I remember that.
I could feel, it was like I was there. I was like, oh my God. And then you guys hiding in the cake for 6 hours.
Dude.
And the shot of you jumping out and getting into the party. And then the montage of inside the party, you're like making out with a model. It's
very random. Covered in face makeup afterwards. Yeah.
And then people are chanting, oompa, oompa, and you jump in the pool. Like there's... watching that again as a young guy, like going into college, I think it was doing the same thing it was doing for you guys with your friends, where first off, like the Playboy Mansion as a dude is like this, you have this image of it in your head as like this thing that's all, it's inaccessible. Yeah. Like it's the thing that you just can't access. So it's a perfect representation of what you guys did. It's like you access the inaccessible. Mm-hmm. Tom, our mentor would always say this. He was like, it has to be, you have to make it attainable. Like it has to be, you don't have resources. You don't know anybody. You're just being creative with how you get in. And so like, I think that's where I really started to learn that from you guys. Cause yeah, just establish it. And it was literally like I did a drug watching that. I was like, oh, I need more. I need more now. Like whatever I need to do to get more of this, I need more. Yeah. Yeah.
That moment when I just got a flashback. The biggest, one of the most euphoric moments of my life. We could not contact them in that cake. I don't know. The cell reception didn't work. So nobody knew the crew, us for 6 hours. We had no idea if they were alive. We didn't know what was going on. And then we're in the bus and we hear these guys run into the bus. They're sopping wet, blue face makeup, like running down their face. And they're like, we got in. And there's a moment where we're just embracing on the bus, yelling and jumping. And just like the relief that, you know, we did it. And then we realized that we hadn't done it. Because the next day we realized that, oh, we can't do anything with this footage until we clear the mansion. Yeah. And Playboy PR was like, what? You broke into Hugh Hefner's house? You want us to allow you to show how this happens?
It turned into a pretty big thing where they were like, if you air it, we're going to press charges against you.
And the president of MTV.
Yeah. And sue you. So MTV was then like, switched around. We're like, oh, we can't do anything with that. We're like, what?
Well, Hugh Hefner doesn't know about it at this point, but this whole team is like, no way, no chance. We go, we call in every favor. Our production company head calls in every favor. MTV calls in every favor. Not happening. And finally, I remember we're at the production company editing bays, and we're just like, what do we do? And the thought of people not seeing this was the driver. We were like, people need to know. That was it. We're like, our friends got to see this. Like that was it, basically.
Yeah. And it really was like, we were like, this is going to inspire our friends to go after things. Like it was so clear. And we just did the only thing that we could think of. And we wrote Hugh Hefner a handwritten letter and delivered it to his home. We knew where he lived at that point.
And how to get in.
And attached the rough edit of the episode. And he wrote us back and said, you can air the episode. Just know, I'm not very happy with you boys. And I always thought that like my biggest dream was to go to the Playboy Mansion, but getting scolded by Hugh Hefner was so much better.
Oh my God. Honestly, shout out to Hugh Hefner. Because that's epic.
And then like it was so crazy because then the calls were just swift. And that was that.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So two things. One, the execs, the producers, the people that like had doubted you up to this point, they gave you creative control, but did they have a reaction? Were they like, holy shit, they actually pulled it off?
They're dumbfounded. Only one person made money. Oh, there was a betting pool and only one person bet that we were going to make it. Noah Oppenheim.
Yes.
He's the only person that bet that we were going to make it. Everyone else put in money that we were going to fail.
Wow. And you just said that
I had a meditation, a guided meditation this morning to get ready for the potty. And it said, bring up a moment of joy where you just felt pure bliss and joy and like bring it in. And what came in was the moment that we popped out of the cake and ran into the mansion because I just couldn't believe in that moment. I couldn't believe that was my reality. I could not believe it was happening. And I also couldn't believe that right away we realized we could do anything we wanted because they thought that we were working the party. So like I just ran and jumped on the stage and put my arm around Snoop Dogg and was just like rocking back and forth. And that moment where 300 people or the whole party is chanting Oompa, Oompa, and we do cannonballs. When I hit the water of that grotto, it was like heaven.
The holy water.
I was done. It was like, oh my God. It's one of the greatest moments.
Your shit eating grin when you came back out. Also, this is also hilarious. So there's party photographers at the party. So this is pre-camera phones, mm-hmm. right? So we would film a lot of our episodes with flip cams.
Yeah, we were watching it. You guys are always holding the flip cams.
Always flip cams.
Hilarious.
So, pre-camera phone. So there's always party photographers. I mean, there still is now, but back then, like you would look to see the photos from the party and we see them get uploaded and we're flipping through it and there's these photos of these playmates and then sopping wet Dave with makeup running down his face with this huge shit eating grin.
Terrifying.
It looks like absolutely terrifying.
Scary. Yeah.
It is so funny. Oh my God. What a laugh. Yeah. It was wild. So.
Oh man.
That was like just the first episode.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Like there's a moment in the book where I tell Thomas about you guys. And I ask him, I'm like, have you seen The Buried Life? Because we're talking about making this list for the summer. It's even hearing your story, I'm like, wow, it's so interesting because we started with just doing 30 days, just like you did 2 weeks. It was like, it's just going to be 30 fun days, whatever. But before we started, we were talking about all these ideas and I was like, it's so much like this show. And he was like, no. And Thomas, the day Thomas and I met, which was like a few months before this, the first story Thomas ever told to me was sneaking into a Flume concert. Was like, it was like the most insane creative way to get in, not only to the Flume concert with three of his buddies that he got in, but afterwards finding out where the VIP party was on the boat, going into the VIP line, putting on an Australian accent and getting into the boat on the second floor, meeting Flume, becoming friends with Flume and his manager. So and good. Then every time Flume would come to Montreal, he'd hang out with Flume. So dude, I heard this story and I was like, then when we were hanging out and coming up with ideas, I was like, dude, you are going to freak because these guys are doing exactly what you've been doing your whole freaking life. And so Thomas puts it on. And I remember we were sitting on separate couches. I was like, the TV was there. I was on this couch and he was on the other side. And I remember looking at him and it was like somebody had like told him the meaning of life. It was like somebody had just shaken, like he'd been sleeping and he just got shaken awake.
Oh my God.
To this day, I don't think I've ever seen him like that.
Wow.
It was like a switch went off.
Yep.
And then literally at 3 a.m. that morning, he texted me saying, giving the idea for Project 30. So literally the impetus for what became this started because of that episode, which is fucking wild. Cause you guys could have easily, you know, been like, oh, I can't air. Like we're going to get in trouble, whatever. But to write a handwritten letter to Hugh fucking Hefner with the freaking episode is just like the impact that that bold decision has is, again, it's the ripple effect. Like you have no idea what taking brave action or like self-belief action will do, you know? So I think it's just like a testament to just taking the risk.
Oh man. And it's easier when you have your friends with you.
Yeah, true.
You know,
pushing you.
Yeah, because the most of the things I, if not all of them, I would not have done on my own.
Mm-hmm.
And I think most of us would feel that way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It was that collective courage and the accountability and the belief too, you know, just the overall collective will and belief. Because what I didn't feel like I believed, one of the four guys did. And they were like, no, we can do this.
Yeah. And the accountability is so huge because like you'd go onto like some solo adventure on one of, you know, to sneak in somewhere or to, you know, accomplish something. And you just would be like, I got to come back to the boys and I got to report back something. So it's like, I got to do something.
Yeah.
You know, you can relate so well to that.
Yeah.
And I will say, because we got put onto you guys almost instantly.
Mm-hmm.
And when you guys got to Trudeau.
Oh, yeah.
I was like, holy shit. This is like, even for me at that time, I can't remember where we were in our careers at that time. But I was like, I was reinvigorated. I was like, you really, if you put it out there, mm-hmm. you can really do anything.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
To clarify, so the Trudeau was, we wanted to take, and this for us was our audition video to get the deal with Snapchat. So to come out to LA, Liz Murdoch had to look at an episode.
Wow.
A 3-minute cut. And so the producer was like, find the biggest, craziest idea you have, put it together in a 3-minute cut, and we'll see what she says.
Wow.
So we were like, fuck it, balls to the wall. We're going to go for the new prime minister of Canada, and we're going to take a holiday card photo with him.
So good.
And so we show up in our crazy Christmas sweaters at his town hall in Ottawa with no plan. Same thing. We're like, we have no idea what we're going to do once we get there. And it was just like talking to one person after the next, just like telling them about the idea, kind of like you guys were doing, you know, with the newspapers and the news anchors and stuff. It's like telling the idea and everybody is like, interesting. And they saw the Christmas sweater, so they immediately laughed because you're four friends.
Yeah.
You look ridiculous. It's so inviting.
Yeah.
And so we get the photo with Trudeau, and that was also a big moment for us, obviously because of the deal, but also for that reason where we were like, that's the, like, everybody's talking about this guy. He was literally everywhere. He was like young, handsome, progressive, like viral mm-hmm. gold. And we, within a day, just showed up and got a, like a Christmas, he's in our holiday card photo. What? Like, it's that easy? Mm. And so it was like, I think throughout our time that kept happening where like the idea seems impossible. This person seems unreachable. And just by saying with your friends, like, why, what if we try this? What if we try that? And like you said, accountability, having a friend be like, no, let's do it. So, I mean, yeah, I have a few things. There's so much I want to bring up. I feel like I could go for 5 hours, but there is one interesting I wanted to bring up because I was thinking about this yesterday, and when I was in college before all of this happened, in 2012, I tweeted you on October 8th, 2012. I said, Dave, I'm thinking of starting a big project myself. I think it was like a company at the time. Do you wish you had finished university before starting The Buried Life? And you tweeted back. I still remember where at McGill I was when you tweeted at me. And you said, you have to do what feels right and is the smartest for your well-being. I left school when The Buried Life became too much, so It was the Buried Life for school. And then you said, and no regrets. I was like, holy shit, what the fuck just happened? He just saw me. He just answered me. I was bugging out, but like,
wow. First of all, I want to shake my own hand. That was about 100 times more intelligent than I thought it was going to be.
That's about 1,000 times more intelligent than I thought it was going to be.
That's great.
Great work. Great work. Dude, you should be proud.
Oh my gosh. I'm tripping out. That's so wild.
Yeah. And then, I mean, 3 years later, because I mean, it's a whole thing, but Amar has the permit to climb the Great Pyramid of Giza. Mm-hmm. Duncan wants to climb the pyramid. Mm-hmm. So they connect. Yeah. That's how we first get on a call with Duncan when we're in Montreal. But when we moved to LA, Amar comes up to me one day. He's like, they want to have dinner with us. Like the Buried Life wants to have dinner with us. And this was not even a year into us starting. And you guys lived like not even that far, like down the street in Venice. So super close to us. And I mean, I hate to be like, because now that we're fully reminiscing, like I'm putting myself back in that place, you know, of being like, holy shit. Like what is going on? Like what is happening? Like I'm 23 and I had like, this was a distant dream. Like this, these people were on a screen and I'm about to have dinner with them. We're going to talk. Amar was so chill about it. He's like, dude, you're being a little too much right now. Thomas was freaking out too, because he had become like a huge fan since I showed him the episodes. But you guys were kind enough to invite us out. And again, this is so seared in my memory, but I remember showing up at the door. Johnny opened it. And then you guys were, it was at Ben's house and you guys came out of the kitchen. I'll actually read you the passage from the book because I think it does kind of
cool.
Speak to it a little bit. But I think it also taught me when people watch Yes Theory and they're big fans, what they must be experiencing. So it also helped me empathize because it's such a bizarre feeling like this parasocial relationship, you know, feeling like you know somebody on a screen, but they don't know you. Mm-hmm. So it goes, as we closed the door behind us, out came Ben, Duncan, and Dave, not from a parallel universe, but from inside the house. I tried to keep my composure with every hug and hello. It was like my screen had come alive in front of me. Like I had entered a high def virtual reality experience. It was just so strange seeing their 3D physical living, breathing presences all interacting with me. And even more bizarre was that I knew so much about them and they had no clue who I was. When Dave cracked a joke, I laughed and thought, classic Dave. Until I caught myself realizing how weird that was. I couldn't treat them like we were already friends, so I refrained from saying too much so as not to slip up. But isn't that such a wild, like... I'm sure you guys have experienced it with, you know, people that you've looked up to and celebrities and stuff that you've met, but it's such a, there's so much going on in your brain because you're like, wow, I want to make a good impression. I want to sound cool, be just as cool. I want them to care, you know, and I want them to hang out with me again. How do I do all those things? How do I make that happen? Like, it's so hard to be yourself. Yeah. But what was epic is that at first it's like a, you know, we're just getting to know each other. So it was a little like, I felt a little awkward about what I was saying, but as the night progressed, and I don't know if it was because of the beers or just getting like more comfortable and whatnot, but, and there were moments in between that made it more comfortable, but I'll never forget being in the kitchen. It was you, me, Amar, and Duncan, and you guys were sharing some stories about your time behind the scenes in the Buried Life, like some of the crazy stuff that happened. And I was like, cackling, like I couldn't stop laughing. And yeah, again, that was like a shift for me. It's like, wow, this, they're literally just like us. Like it, we're a younger version of them doing a very similar thing. And then from that point on, I mean, you guys have just been such incredible friends and mentors. And there have been moments throughout, like especially in 2017, 2018, when we were really starting to come up, where you guys would reach out to us. And I remember specific times. And you'd be like, you're doing it. Like, keep going. And be like, holy shit, no way, dude. Yeah.
Yeah, man. It's It's been a cool journey though, because, you know, it's so easy to stop. There's so many times that you can stop. And with you guys, and I think I can speak for, you know, all of us, is like, there was so many chances where you guys could have been like, all right, and now we're going to go our other ways. And you just kept pushing, kept on getting better. The content kept on getting better. The first piece of content I ever saw from you guys was, and I could be wrong here, but so don't quote me exactly. But you came back from Cuba and you were doing some boxing with, mm-hmm. and I was like, when are you guys going to box? And you're like, oh, I don't think we didn't box. And I was like, well, who are you boxing? And they're like, oh, we didn't box. And I was like, motherfuckers, what? You better be boxing. Mm-hmm. If you're going to go to Cuba and you're going to go to a boxing ring, then you better be boxing. And then I got to see every year your content, this gets so much better. Mm. And just like so involved and so many more risks and so much vulnerability and so putting it on the line, and the inspiration that pumped into the world and continues to pump. It's like, it's just beautiful. It's so cool to see. And I just think that it's really a testament to you as a core to keep each other going, mm-hmm. and ride through all those hard moments. Cause there mm-hmm. were so many, you mm-hmm. guys had so many chapters.
Was it, sorry, go for it, Ben.
Well, I just think it's so cool that, you know, you talk about this story of you being inspired by us. And then this full circle moment started to happen where, you know, I know I can speak for Dave, and like a week, we started to get inspired by you guys.
100%.
And like I started to totally get re-inspired to kind of evolve into this next chapter of what I'm doing now. You know, just by seeing you guys, as Dave said, like just not stopping, you know, but also because we saw you in the beginning. Mm-hmm. So we knew where you came from and what you're doing and how you just kept getting better and pushing it, and the bar that you were setting, you kept raising it. Mm-hmm. And that was awesome. Inspiring, you know, and then it was just like sort of being in that ecosystem of also not only the content, but the community that you created here and the big ideas, the big dreams, the scale that they start to operate at. And it's like, they're like, well, I have no choice now, mm-hmm. but to push it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because like they're doing it.
Yeah. And then to bring it even more full circle.
Maybe the second circle, you could say.
Yeah, second circle.
Wait, so I didn't bring it full circle? You're bringing it more full circle? I brought it three-quarter circle.
Get me out of these circles. This is like the box.
Let me just bring a little more full circle than Dave's going to bring it. It's
God.
Close it up here.
No, but to continue the sphere, when we were coming here, when I was flying here, I was saying to people, like, you know, I've got a haircut and, you know, just kind of in conversation, like, why are you going to LA? I'm going to do the podcast. Oh, what podcast? Yes Theory. And three people said to me a similar version of the same line of like, oh, when I'm feeling down, I watch Yes Theory. Mm. When I need to be motivated, I watch Yes Theory. And I'm like, oh my heart. Oh. It's just, it was so beautiful and cool to hear. And it just made me so fired up to get out here and do this. So
thanks, dude.
Yeah.
Man, appreciate that. For you guys, because what's interesting is you guys will win 2 years doing the show. We were coming up on, I mean, I haven't been in videos, but the channel has been, we're coming up a little over 8 years now. Mm-hmm. And I think that's also really interesting. Sometimes I imagine what you guys would have done if you started when we did, you know, if you had YouTube, if you, like in the way that we have it now as content creators. Is that something you guys ever think about how it would have, like if you were... Say if you were doing The Buried Life now, would you do it pretty much in the same way, just on YouTube?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I think we could have kept, we could have totally done it on YouTube after the TV show, but we had pretty big egos.
And sometimes you got to go on to the next thing.
Yeah. No, but I think like, you know, and like being totally honest, we were like, we need to get back on TV. Yeah. Mm. We were like, we got to do another show.
Because the show got canceled.
Show got canceled. So we're like, all right, like we need to be back on TV. And we started the production company to get another show on TV. And then we started producing other people's shows.
Yeah. Do you know who would be great to pick up our show? Us.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. And we did it. And then, you know, we kind of got wrapped up in making other shows. We did that for a couple of years. Then we got burnt out doing shows, doing production. And then at that point, we'd all evolved so much that we were kind of like on this path individually. Mm. But yeah, I think we would have, and we, you know, if it was right now, we'd definitely do it on YouTube for sure.
Yeah. It's so funny. When the show got canceled, there was an element because the show got canceled and we've been going for 7 years. I think that's right.
Yeah.
The timing's
right. 2012, yeah. 20s, yeah.
We're pretty tired, pretty burnt. Yeah. So like the idea of going into YouTube, which was starting to percolate at that time.
Yeah.
We were pretty wiped.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, needed to find more individuality at that time too, which is kind of the opposite direction of getting the unit together to like grind. So I think we were like pretty.
Yeah, I think it's true. That's a good point. And we had also, we felt like we were kind also, some part of us was happy that we didn't get another season because we didn't know how to keep raising the bar. And we realized we were in a trap. We, you know, play basketball with Obama, like all these, we had to keep one-upping ourselves. And we realized that wasn't a scalable format.
You want to know the craziest shit?
Please.
You guys want to know some crazy shit?
This is the place to do it, Dave.
So the one-upping on the end, on the back of season two, at the MTV Video Awards again, Kanye had just grabbed the mic from Taylor and was doing his comeback performance at the VMAs. And we were like, let's amp up. And so I got tearaway suit with a thong and had written, "This is for Taylor" on my back. We got front row tickets to those awards. And I was about to streak Kanye's performance and I had to, there was something in my wardrobe that was like fucking up and I had to go to the bathroom. So it was like, I think it was like 10 minutes before Kanye was going to perform. So I was like, oh, whatever. So I had to go to the bathroom and I had to put on my thong. Sorry, that's what it was. I had to put on my thong. So
it's like a dancer's thong. So it's like,
yeah, exactly.
See through at the back and there's like a skin colored strap.
Yeah.
In the front.
And then I was walking back and security stopped me. And they're like, it's a commercial or we're shooting this section of the audience right now. We can't have you go back right now. And I was like, oh, I need to get back there. I need to get to my seat. Yeah, I'm sitting third row. Like I really have to get back. And they're like, no. Like you have to wait for a commercial break. So at a certain point, the director was like, we're not doing commercial. Go straight into Kanye. And I was like, oh no. So then Kanye starts his performance. I am like two blocks back from my seating and I've got this huge security guy in front of me and I'm like, Dave, are you going to try and deke this guy? And this, like, as soon as that thought went into my mind, I must have like started going like, and the security guard was like, whoa, what's going on here? And started squaring up to me. And I'm like, and I'm like panicking. I'm like, do I do this? Do I just rip off everything and fucking get on stage for this performance? And the guy just like essentially just started to like crowd me in because he knew that something was going on. and then Kanye performed, I didn't streak, and it was done. But I guess the reason I tell the story is our mindset was getting pretty kooky.
We would do anything.
I think, like, in particular me, if we did a third season, there's a strong chance I would have died. Cause I was I was starting to push so hard. Mm-hmm. And like when I start pushing, like it's really pushing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Dude, I can empathize with that. I mean, obviously so much. The Will Smith jump was that lot of ways where it was after that happened, there wasn't like an exact moment, but there was a feeling of what do we do after this? Like what? Like it's only been 3 years and that happened. And, you know, so I still remember being in this house like a year after that being like, do we challenge Richard Branson to go to space or Elon to like, do we, like we were thinking about driving a Tesla around the SpaceX headquarters and convincing Elon to join us in the car. Like we had this mindset of like bigger, crazier people, crazier, freaking like out, literally outer space. And I think, you know, now the direction Yes Theory is going in with like, it's much more travel content and like, exploring new places, new people, etc., feels much more sustainable. Like going after these things feels limited. Like you will, like you said, it'll start to get ugly because that it turns from this excitement and this newness to like, oh, we got, it's like a drug. I got to keep this up. Like the people want this. And like, again, the burnout that contributes to the burnout too. Cause you're like, I just gotta keep, but you're pushing when you shouldn't.
Yeah. I think you bring up a really good point, which is something that I think took us a while to learn, but ironically is why we started this in the very first place, which is the importance of being true to yourself. And we got to the point where we weren't actually being authentic. We were doing what we thought we needed to do to continue to have success. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until we all gut checked and we're like, what do I actually want to do? Where we started to be like, oh, it's okay for us to continue to do our own thing and follow our own path, which, you know, from the conversations that we've had is the same mm-hmm. thing that you felt is like, at some point you feel inauthentic and you realize that you're not living for you. You're living the story that you've told yourself, or you're living the story that you think you should live. And that's what I was living when I got depressed in high school. Mm-hmm. And writing my list was the first time I'd ever written down what I actually wanted. And then when I did it, it was liberating. When I talked about it, it was exciting. And then I felt more alive. And anytime I hit it down, it's when I'm being inauthentic in a major area of my life, whether it's a relationship or the job I'm doing. You know, after the production company, I got depressed.
While you were building the production company?
Yeah. Mm. That's why I left, because I was like, guys, I can't do it, because I was spending so much time doing something that I actually really didn't love. And I realize when I get depressed, it's because in large part, there's a big area of my life where I'm not being true to who I authentically am. And when I shift, it's very hard, but I start to feel back into the flow of life. I start to feel like things are happening for me versus like things are hard. I start to feel energy. And so when you follow that, you know, you start to feel more true to yourself and more alive. And really that's what this journey has been. This whole journey has been a journey of self-discovery, of figuring out who we are, and things change. And as you grow, you change. And I think it's important to follow that, because if you don't, then you get down a track where you're doing something that you think you have to do because it's the right thing to do. But in reality, it's okay to change your course. In fact, it's normal.
Yeah. I always like something that I started looking at is like, you never want to live yourself as a brand. Like when you start looking at yourself as a brand, like what's the brand of David Lingwood? I think that's like a dangerous path. Like when it comes to like your individuality, like you just want that essence to come out purely. Mm-hmm. You don't want to like create your own package.
Which is hard with social media because you have to kind of.
Yeah.
Very hard. Super hard. And that full self-expression is really, I think, what you're looking for.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've always had a hard time with social media, and I've always thought like, if I can just be myself, if I can just be that true expression, then I won't have to overthink it, and I can just be myself. And that's my goal, is to get to that place where I can be that. And it's really that alignment of understanding what you want, right? Like taking the time to figure out what is it that I want, whether that's having conversation with friends, taking quiet time, writing your list, talking with a therapist, trying new things, but not to put so much pressure on yourself to be like, what's my purpose? It's just like, just try these things and see if they energize you. And if they do, then do more of it. And that's your path.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like that's it.
Yeah.
Because at the end of your life, you're going to regret not trying those things that you wanted to do. Guaranteed. That's the regret that people have on their deathbed. And so you at least have to try. And I think that's what sparked people in the beginning, was we gave them permission to try.
Yeah.
And deep down, everyone has something they want to do. And majority of people never do it. And our thing was like, maybe we can just trigger people. Like our friend who started his clothing line triggered us mm-hmm. to be like, you can try. Then at least if you try, then you don't have to regret never yeah. trying.
Yeah.
And that's when magic happens.
And Ben, I will say that when I watch your social media, I do feel like I'm getting an accurate, like it feels like I'm hanging out with you in real life.
Mm.
Thank so you. I appreciate that.
I think, you know, credit to you and what you're doing.
Hell yeah.
Thank you.
Has it been, I mean, Ben, I know you, I mean, you're like number two motivational speaker in America or something, or in the world or whatever.
The world.
And you talk about the buried life quite often in the work.
Yeah.
And does it for you, like when you are talking about it, and Dave, for you, when you do you guys think about it often? And is there anything that you wish, like, do you miss it, I guess is the question. Like whenever you talk about it, like even today, or even just think about it, is there a part of you that's like, that kind of wishes you had stayed together and continued down this road? Or are you very happy that you went your individual paths?
I feel like I went through this natural kind of like re-inspiration that I felt around the project, which I needed to take separation from it before I got re-inspired by it. And so, you know, like Dave said, like we were done. We were over it. Like by the time, we also did a ton of speaking mm-hmm, as a, we burnt ourselves out. We were yeah. doing, we did 200-300 colleges in 2 years. We were partying every night with everybody, getting up at 5 a.m., going to the next college. And by the time that was finished, we were all hanging up the boots. And we started the production company and did the, and just by chance, I accepted a TEDx talk and then I regretted it, but then I did it. And from that sparked the speaking, because someone saw it and they asked me to come speak. And when I started speaking, I saw how fired up everyone was getting about this story. And I was like, I thought this was old news. Like, you know, I didn't think anybody would care. But 50-year-old executives, like, you know, of all different backgrounds, people of all ages, they were just like, that was such a good story. You and your friends. That's so cool. And I was like, oh yeah, I guess maybe it is. And then I started to sort of think about what lessons were learned. Because the other thing about buried life is like, we never wanted to tell our friends how to live their life. And so we never were prescriptive. Like this was very important to us. The only thing we would do is we would ask the question, what do you want to do before you die? That was it. We would never give any life lessons because we never wanted to tell our friends how to live their life. And we never wanted our friends to tell us how to live. But finally, we did a Tim Ferriss blog and we had to. And this was in promotion for the book. And Tim Ferriss used to only have a blog. It was like the biggest blog on the internet, basically. And so he said, for you to do a blog, you need to give my readers real takeaway. And you have to write it. I'm not saying I'm going to post it, but I'm going to decide after you write it whether I post it. And we did, you know, 5 or 6 steps to crossing anything off your bucket list. That was the first time we ever thought about the lessons we learned. And from there, I started to realize that this went deeper and deeper. And I started to read this research that talked about people regretting at the end of their life, not living for them. That's the biggest regret we have as human beings, is not living for me, living for other people. I was like, oh shit, that's a big fucking problem. 3/4 of the world is going to live their whole life and realize on their deathbed, I blew it. I fucked it up. That's an issue. And then I was like, oh, that's what your bucket list is. It's not just skydive. It's not just travel to Europe. It's those things that are super important to you that you will regret not doing. It's telling someone how you really feel. It's doing that dream that you will regret not doing. It's taking time to be present, to be with your family. It's all the things that the day-to-day bury. Mm. And I was like, oh, this is the human condition. The poem was written 150 years ago, and we're getting more and more buried because of technology. This is going to get worse and worse. And that is the deeper message that I start to understand and realize that everybody needs this wake-up call. At any point, I need it, Dave needs it, we all need it, because the day-to-day gets in the way, but this is really important stuff. And these are the things we're going to regret if we don't act on them. And that's why I started speaking. And so I got re-inspired by this message once I came back to it in my own way. And, you know, maybe you feel a little bit like that, like coming back and kind of doing this podcast and be like, okay, this is like, now this is like Matt's version, where Matt is from your perspective, mm-hmm. from your authentic self, and probably feels better.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing that, dude. Yeah. My New Year's resolution this year was, stand up and be seen as I am. Mm. And for most of Yes Theory, I mean, I would share sometimes in newsletters where I was struggling or what I was going through and stuff, but with this book, with this podcast, with the newsletter, with everything that I'm doing now, there's this feeling of, oh, this is who I am. And it's not necessarily pretty. Like, I cried this morning about this. Like, it's difficult. And I think this format and these formats that I've chosen are, allow me to express that in my own way, which I didn't have as much before. But at the same time, and like, not to spoil, but this is how the book ends as well, which is like, I don't know what I want. I literally have no idea. Like, I haven't actually fully stopped myself to ask that question. And like you said, in order for you to properly answer that question, you need space. You need time away from whatever the thing was before. And so whatever comes next is that. The goal is to really take the space to ask myself, which is, when you've never done it your whole life, is a really scary concept. Mm-hmm. It's a really scary idea. So yeah, I mean, that's also why I'm asking you guys how it's been for you since you left, because, you know, it's like the closest thing that I have to what we built is you guys. Mm-hmm. So to see you all crushing, loving your lives, doing what you love, and not necessarily always being together, mm-hmm. is very much making it easier. It's like the ease of my departure is much smoother because of it. So yeah.
I think you bring up a really good point of finding the, so you found these outlets that are kind of enablers of you to be your true authentic expression. The newsletter, write the book, writing, these types of things. And that's the goal, right? That for me, it's speaking. For me, you know, it's also writing, it's also content, but it has to come from this true place, because you need to have that ease where it energizes you. And that's when you create this momentum forward, where it's like a two-way relationship, where you're getting energy from the work you do, but you're also giving energy to other people. And that is just something that you have to test. Like, you just have to get out and just try different things and know that it's okay when you fail. Because you're not even failing. You're just collecting data. You're just going out there trying something and you're collecting the data of like, does this give me energy? Does this make me feel more alive? Does this make me feel more like myself? And if yes, you keep doing it. If no, then great. Now I know that doesn't it. That's not it. I'm going to try something else. Like TV, not it, right? You know, I mean, Dave's been trying a bunch of things and it's like, once you get that, you're like, oh yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I think also just because I did this in the last 2 years is I kind of had like a stop down moment.
Stop down.
Yeah. And I woke up and I was like, I'm going to love this moment. And I woke up every day and I mapped out different ideas that I could do. And I became in love with the adventure of finding out what the next adventure is. And instead of being like, because I was framing it before I reframed it into like, oh God, like, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? And I was just panicking and I was like, oh God, like just felt like a failure. And then I was like, you know what? Let's just like enjoy the process of figuring out what the most ideal thing that I could do is. Hmm. And I just brainstormed and I loved it. I had so much fun. I threw so many ideas. I built so many decks. I wrote so many different business plans. And then I landed on, you know, something that I really wanted to do. And I went after it after 6 months.
Damn.
So I think like as you're going into your next phase, like love the process. Like it's so fucking exciting that you don't know what you're going to do next. That's fucking badass.
Yeah. And there's also no rules. God. You know what I mean?
I thought it was matching energy. It was like, I kind of like, I could have had a better denouement. I admit it. I could have had a better exclamation mark. But then he was like, kind of like, kind of like half queen wave me.
Cupping.
Cupping.
Dude.
I love the so potty.
Good. So the good.
P-O-D-D-Y.
Yeah, because it got to.
So I think the other thing too is like, there's just no fucking rules. Like once you realize that there's no rules with anything in your life, like you decide. You create the life. You create the rules. But it's so easy to think that you have to do something, right? But once you realize that you create whatever you want and that there's also not, you don't have anything but the present moment. There's no past. There's no future. They don't exist. All you have is this moment. This moment will be the future, but it's just, that's all you have right now. If you are not present in that moment and enjoying that moment, you don't have anything. And so you create everything in that moment. You decide. You decide how you feel. You decide what you do. You decide what you create. And when you think that there are these rules and these boxes and these guidelines that you have to abide by, then you start living someone else's life. And even us, who we preach that. That's like, well, that's our job. You, that's your job. Yeah. That was both of our job. You get into this season of telling yourself you have to do this now. And that's made up.
Mm-hmm.
And you create it. You create it. And you think that people are out there and they really, really like, they want you to do this or they really care. And none of that matters.
They don't actually care that much.
They don't care. The only thing that matters is that you're happy in that moment. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all other people want for you.
Yeah.
And so you're just sort of looking for that contentment and that fulfillment. And
I mean, speaking of rules, I'm definitely breaking the rule of below an hour for the pod. So fuck it. I'm living my own. This is my going away party. I do what I want. Whatever the listeners
going away and
viewers. Well, what are we at? How are you? 46. Longest pod yet. Tell us. Congrats. God. It's an honor.
It's the T-boy. It's yeah. The best one yet.
Yeah. I think maybe to like put a beautiful period on the end of this chapter, one thing I am really excited about that's coming that is definitely already in the works is this thing that we're working on together.
Yeah.
Which is this documentary, The Ripple Effect.
Yeah.
This story. I mean, a lot of, we've talked about it in, in this podcast throughout, but how cool. How cool that we're going to tell the story of that idea.
Yeah. Get ready for a lot of vintage footage because it's so interesting. We filmed everything. Mm. So the fact that, you know, we can fill in some of those stories with the actual footage because we just had the little handheld, and it's something that this all started to make a documentary. Like, that was the project and it never got made. So the fact that we're doing it now is just, it's unbelievable. It's surreal, honestly. Mm-hmm.
It's surreal. I mean, it is my life's biggest dream is to make this film.
Really?
Yeah, 100%. And like, how cool, like that you were inspired by us to live your dream, and now you're making our dream come true. Like, it's so fucking cool.
Yeah.
And like, I don't even... It's just like, this is such a big thing for us, you know? It's just like, and for me, I mean, I speak for myself. It's like, this is something that I know is it. This is the thing. This is the purpose of what we did. And this is the legacy piece. And to be able to do it with you guys and the amount of fun it's going to be to put it together and go through old footage and just like, that's why we did this. Like Dave said, like, this is like, we never finished.
Yeah.
This is like us actually bringing it full circle.
Yeah. It feels like a dream.
Wow.
So fucking
like
cool.
Genuinely like wow. That it has that just complete surreal. I can't believe that this is how it's happening. It feels, freaking cool.
Yeah. You can't script it.
It's going to be fire. It's going to be so,
I mean, it might be the best documentary ever. Yeah. Not to like hype it up too soon, but I think we all know where this is going.
Yeah, for the next hour of the pod, yeah. We will be hyping up this documentary. Yeah.
I mean, when do you think we've already kind of started laying the groundwork for it? Yeah. We're even filming for it right now. Do we have an estimated time of when people could expect this to come out, or not yet?
Yeah, I mean, we'll put this out there. We're hoping to have it out by December 2024. That's the goal. Nice. December of next year. So, you know, we're working really closely with Amar and Kate, and you know, it's going to be such a fun ride. I'm so excited. We're going to start looking at the old footage. We have, you know, terabytes of footage. And so, the coolest part is, you know, pre-MTV show, mm-hmm. the 3 years that we did it on our own, mm-hmm. and this handy, I mean, we filmed with like, you know, mini DV tapes. We have VHS of us as kids. It's like you see us grow up over 10 years and then into this ripple effect that inspired you guys. But the coolest part is like now we're hearing all these stories of people that were inspired by the show that we had no idea that are far bigger than we are, yeah. Right? Like people that are monsters out in the world right now, musicians, creators, athletes who were kids in high school that saw the show and thought, oh yeah, shit, maybe I can do the mm-hmm. thing, and went off to make a far greater impact than us. So the goal of the documentary is to prove the ripple effect, quantify, show as if it's a math equation, that's a truth, that one person can change the world. Because this one kid that started this clothing line,
Aaron,
that the clothing line wasn't successful, right? No one would know about it. He's not doing that right now. In all sort of, if you look at it, you're like, well, that was a failure. Well, if he wouldn't have started that clothing line, none of this would have happened. Buried Life wouldn't have happened. Yesterday wouldn't have happened. All these other people would not do their thing. And you trace that back to this one kid that just did this clothing line because he wanted to, because he told Dave, you can do whatever you want. And just by seeing someone that we knew do something great, it made us think that we could do something great. And then it's started this cascade of impact. And so that's proof right there that one kid can change the world because he did it and no one even knows it. And that's the film is going to be proving that, so that anyone that needs to feel the feeling that you felt when you watched that episode, that trigger, that spark of like, I need that. That's the feeling that we want to evoke with this documentary. And that's the goal.
You know what makes it so powerful is it changes the definition of success completely. Mm-hmm. Into the success is in the doing, because the outcome is not in your control. Whatever happens is not in your control. So it goes back to the process and not the outcome, and shows it, like you said, like mathematically, this is true. Mm-hmm. What happened? Is Aaron aware of what's happening right now? Does he have any idea that this is going down?
He doesn't know that no, he doesn't.
He's going to watch this documentary and be like, what?
Yes, he will. Yeah.
I mean, he knows that he inspired us. We've all told him, he knows that.
Yeah. My section in the book and What Do You Want to Do Before You Die is about Aaron. Mm. So he's aware.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
So, I mean, I do want to ask, it seems like a perfect time. What do you want to do before you die?
Oof. What do I want to do before now it's happening to me. Now the full circle is coming back. I'm that guy that's going to run down the street 30 minutes later.
The pod's running short, so we got time.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, this book is probably it. You know, it's the idea of being an author is such a wild experience for me, you know, and I don't actually know how to become a best-selling author. There's like certain calculations you can do, but just the idea of writing a book that can help people ask that question of what they want in their lives as I'm asking it myself. So not, again, telling them what to do, but just being like, hey, this is what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. I think actually holding the book, I haven't held it yet. I'm holding it literally tomorrow for the first time.
Incredible.
After 3 years of work and to see it go out in the world. Sometimes I have fears of, I'm like, oh, fuck, if I die before this thing comes out, that would suck so much. It will be the first thing I thought about. I'll think about, I actually remember Rick Rubin on a podcast saying he was in his house and it caught on fire in the middle of the night. He was next to his wife and she runs out of the bedroom, grabs the kid and goes down. She screams fire and he's in his bed. And for some reason he falls back asleep. He doesn't think much of it. He wakes up like 5-10 minutes later and he can't see the hand in front of his face. And so he gets off the bed and starts crawling to try to find the stairs to get out. And he literally says, he's like, I'm about to die. And the only and first thought I have in my head is, thank God I finished the book. Mm-hmm. Thank God I finished the book, because his book came out this year and it's about everything he learned in his process. Mm. Eventually, obviously, he's still alive. He found a window and managed to get down. But that really struck me. It was like these creative projects, like you're saying, this is your dream to make this documentary, but for both of you. And I mean, for me to see it come out would just be so surreal as well. But this book, to see it go out and tell this story of what's happened with you guys in it, with all these different moments and stuff, and to see people holding it myself with my own eyes, I think would be like that for me. It would be a moment of, thank God I did this.
That's so cool. I mean, yeah, the fact that you answered it, like, I don't want to die before the book comes out.
True.
You know, that's the answer.
True.
That is the answer. That's a great one.
Thanks, man. Yeah.
It's well, proud of you, brother.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for doing this. My God, this was epic. I'm so grateful.
Wow.
Did you feel it too? I felt it.
I feel so great. Yeah. I see, now I'm kind of in the groove. I'm like, I can't. You guys go home. Let's just keep chatting. We'll unplug the mics. It feels good. It feels natural.
Right? You get like high from it a little bit.
Absolutely. Yeah.
It's in the flint. Wow. It's funny.
Well, I guess
we'll see you guys later. We're going to stay here.
Perfect.
Thanks so much.
Love you, everybody. Thanks for coming, fellas. We did it. We freaking did it.
Peace. Awesome. Woo.